do. It was way more fun to find something that you loved and go with it as far as it would go.
In time, they developed finesse, could whip egg whites to perfection, stopped breaking their bonnets. When they married at the Regency Hotel in New York City in May 1971, they dictated the menu to the more seasoned hotel chefs. Back in Boston, they began catering parties for a very old suburban crowd, remembers Karen. The husband of a Wellesley couple, frequent clients, was president of two stock exchange companies and offered to back the Pritzkers in a restaurant. If they were good enough to attract a benefactor, they figured, they should go into business for themselves. They borrowed $50,000 from Karen's stepfather, about $50,000 more from a bank, and in 1974 opened Dodi Buffon, a prefix dinner-only restaurant on Boylston Street. The name nodded to both novelist Marcel Rouff's La Vie et la Passion du Dodi Buffon Gourmet and a Paris restaurant of the same name. Of taking the restaurant plunge, Karen says,
"The way I think we saw it was, if you're doing it with your life partner, what a support system you have. You were living in your own little world. I don't know that it was thought about. It just felt natural to share with your spouse or your partner something you enjoy. The fact that you were doing it for the public was something of an afterthought."
Following the French model, Bob marketed each morning, but the similarities ended there. The kitchen team was largely unrefined.
"It was pretty haphazard at the beginning," says Karen. "There was Bob and myself and two other cooks in the kitchen. We placed an ad in probably the Boston Globe, and we hired people whose personalities we liked who had done some cooking, but there were no professionals around. It was just sort of fun. Everybody was cooking and talking about food and other things as well."
Because the restaurant was dinner only, the schedule suited people with other careers, especially photographers and artists. The university-rich city echoed the politics of Berkeley. But Bob says that he and Karen weren't part of protest society, but "we were counterculture as to the frogs in Boston, however few they were, who had French restaurants. Most importantly, there was a guy who owned a restaurant, Maison Robert. Maison Robert moved from a less important place to the old city hall, and it was such a snobby act, and he looked down his nose at these two American kids who started cooking French food, of all heretical things, that we weren't entitled to even be cooking." The Pritzkers, in another commonality amongst many of the couples, learned on the job. Karen says that except for the size of the industrial stove in Dodi Buffon's first months, they cooked as amateurs, Karen in a t-shirt and clogs. Customers were few and far between. The staff played hearts during service while Karen and Bob used the lulls to master the fundamentals of timing. But there were other unanticipated challenges. They wanted to be more creative, but lacked the technical foundation that expressiveness demands, so were stuck in the classicism rut, especially after a 1976 tour of France that included visits to Alain Chappelle and Trois Gros. Boston tastemakers weren't receptive to the prefix concept or to the European-style service charge they employed, which in September 1976 prompted local critic David Brudnoy on his Nightline radio show to comment that "the food is fine. The people who run it are pigs." The Pritzkers sued him for defamation. They were unprepared for the scrutiny or the criticism, especially Karen, who developed a reputation for haughtiness. Gail Green, who is friendly with Karen today, attributed the reputation to misread shyness. By 1977, the Pritzkers were at a crossroads. The restaurant was straining the marriage to the breaking point, and they separated. Then the media picked up on the separation, dealing them another blow.
"Everyone knew personal information that was written in the press," says Karen. "I could never put myself through anything but food scrutiny."
"The restaurant didn't close," says Bob. "I continued on without her there. We had to separate. We were in deep trouble interpersonally." Karen retreated to New York City. Eventually, Bob shuttered Dodi Buffon, sold it to Moncef Medeb, who transformed it into the French restaurant L'Espalier. The Pritzkers reconciled, decided to try their hand at recreating Dodi Buffon in Manhattan, enlisting an attorney so that they could pounce when the perfect space presented itself. In January 1979, the Pritzkers opened Dodi Buffon 2.0 in a single-use residential brownstone that they transformed, largely by their own hand over 8 months, into a street-level 50-seat dining room painted pink, white, gray, and blue. The kitchen was subterranean. While they were in construction, Barry Wine, an attorney-turned-chef, strolled in, introduced himself, told them he was thinking of relocating his own restaurant, the Quilted Giraffe, from New Paltz to Manhattan. The Pritzkers' budget blown, the restaurant opened with walls bereft of artwork, freighting the pink tulips that adorned the tables with a tremendous atmospheric burden. Establishing what would become a commonality among the five couples, the Pritzkers had by then broken free of traditional cuisine to cook in their own style.
"Once we knew what we were doing in terms of how long it took to sauté a veal kidney, we could play with the concept," says Karen. "It was a combination of that and the trips we began taking to France. We closed the restaurants in both Boston and New York every July, and we spent a month traipsing through France and seeing what other people were doing. Freddy Girardet, at his self-titled restaurant at the Hôtel de Ville in Crissier, Switzerland. Jacques Pic, at the 3-Michelin-star Maison Pic in Valence, France. Interestingly enough, at Télévan, the creativity wasn't as abundant as it was at Chapelle or Crissier, though the execution was so perfect. But we also learned a lot about service and what guests expect when they get to a great table. We had changed as cooks, and we knew that we wanted to have more fun with the food," says Karen. "We didn't want to do classic food anymore, although we did do certain classic preparations. We knew that if 4 people came to dinner, 3 of them may have had fun with our fun. The 4th might have been more conservative."
The Pritzkers also incorporated an amuse-bouche, which Karen believes they were among the first to do in New York City.
"We felt it very important because we had seen it in our travels and thought it was a nice way of welcoming."
There was also a less altruistic reason.
"We sometimes got backed up in the kitchen, so we knew if we had something on the table, that and bread gave you a little breathing space."
Diners on the American side of the Atlantic had some catching up to do.
"We served rillettes a lot. People would be very circumspect about the fat on top, so we changed it up. We ran with our intelligence," says Karen. "I think all those couples who were running restaurants in New York at that time were smart and curious. And I think our curiosity got most of us to where we eventually wound up."
"And what did they cook?"
"I did a sort of a take on steak au poivre, but it was calf's liver. I also did a vegetable sausage. I know the Waltucks did a seafood sausage, and I did a vegetable sausage, and nobody had ever done a non-meat sausage until then. There was a chicken forcemeat that bound it, not much, and anybody who was vegetarian, we never told them, and they ate it anyway. Chicken forcemeat, egg white, broccoli, carrots, and peas all blanched carefully, not pureed, very finely minced, put into casings, poached, and then sautéed, and served with a beurre noisette and chopped hazelnuts. We also did our own duck pastrami. We used amagret. Took the legs and cured them and hung them in the kitchen in cheesecloth. No temperature control. We monitored them and we used them. We also did gravlax garnished with smoked potatoes and smoked leeks, mixing what we knew classically with really interesting changes.
As in Boston, staffing was catch as catch can.
"We had one Czech who had worked in Europe and had good butchering and charcuterie skills," says Karen. "We hired a young man who had worked in Long Island, whose parents owned an Italian restaurant. He had some kitchen skills, but everybody else we hired, I don't think any of them had professional experience. Year 2 of the restaurant, we did start hiring people who had graduated from the Culinary Institute of America and had more developed prep skills or sugar skills."
One of the Pritzkers' catches was Marc Chayette, a graduate of Michel Gérard's kitchens at Le Pré Déjeuner in France and Regine's in New York City. "A very gifted guy," says Bob. "An unusual guy. A Williams grad. Very cerebral. Great hands. Knives were sharp. Workspace clean.
The towel was always in the apron.
Bob didn't bother with French kitchen conventions, and was so unconcerned with appearances that he thought nothing of visiting the dining room in blood-spattered whites, which became an inadvertent sartorial signature.
I didn't change my apron. I didn't put on a toque. I'm a Jewish kid. Toque? What does that even mean?
New York Magazine's Gail Green praised the food at Dodin Buffon as
original, strikingly personal, even eccentric at times.
She adored the calf's brain fritters with house-pickled cherries, lamb over arugula with baby beans and root vegetable purees. She found the desserts similarly idiosyncratic, breaking with what Green described as French restaurant cliché, such as ricotta pepper tart with nutmeg ice cream. In 1980, Green put Dodin Buffon atop her list of favorite French restaurants of the moment. Mimi Sheridan, in an early iteration of what would become a repeating pattern between her reviews and Green's, was more measured. She found much of the food excellent, awarded Dodin Buffon 2 stars, but was frankly critical of some dishes, and of what she saw as the restaurant's pretensions, including the menu, written in French with no translations.
The Mimi review irked the hell out of us, says Karen. I found it difficult. Bob found it unbearable. He railed at every review that wasn't perfect. There was something obsessive about the way he looked at the press. The night that the New York Times calls you in advance to fact-check, you knew. The fact that Mimi only gave us 2 stars threw him for a real personal loop.
Today, Bob says, it's an expectation thing, I guess. While she praised the food, she didn't give it the 3rd star. That happens. It was a long review. I thought it was enthusiastic. Regardless, Dodin Buffon did a solid business, so solid, in fact, that it was omitted from the 1981 Gold Meal Guide to New York, because the critics had one catastrophic meal, and the restaurant was so solidly booked they were unable to return for a second dinner.
The economy was good. Wall Street was rolling, says Karen. A lot of expense account people coming to dinner. Woody Allen and Mia Farrow. It was the kind of restaurant where you got to see everybody.
Another regular was an increasingly omnipresent Michael McCarty, keeping tabs on the evolution of the food scene on his native coast. Dodin Buffon and the marriage would last less than 4 years in New York City. But let's leave the Priskers in bloom for a moment. The end will come soon enough.
I'm sure if he were doing it now, he'd be into sous vide and liquid nitrogen.
Hubert's began life as a Brooklyn dinner party when Len Allison, an English teacher, who along with girlfriend Karen Hubert, a writer, got it in their heads to make a documentary about a clothing store in Brooklyn, New York. The unlikely odyssey to the professional kitchen began in 1977 when, in a sort of culinary Kickstarter campaign, they staged a series of dinner parties in their Cobble Hill home to raise $10,000 to buy a movie camera. 2 years later, in 1979, the movie hadn't been made. It never would. But Allison and Hubert, who were regulars at John Novi's DePoy Canal House, had taken the plunge into the restaurant business, launched the 12-table Hubert's on Hoyt Street in Borum Hill, in an 1880s house that had been converted to a tin-ceilinged saloon space. It now houses the popular, though resolutely unvarnished, watering hole, Brooklyn Inn. In addition to regular service, the couple hosted a cookbook author series, celebrating new publications by writers such as Edna Lewis and Paula Wolfert. The Times' Sheraton was an early fan.
There was something very dear about the one in Brooklyn, she says. None of the plates matched. Different silver. And it was very sweet, more personal in a way.
She also admired Allison's tendency toward experimentation.
I'm sure if he were doing it now, he'd be into sous vide and liquid nitrogen. He had that kind of mind.
With time, Allison and Hubert developed their technical skills and a repertoire of recipes. By July 1981, seeking sufficient clientele to maintain their business, they relocated to larger quarters at 102 East 22nd Street in Manhattan. The space, in what would become a minor design trend, celebrated the street scene outside by omitting curtains in the windows. The restaurant would move again to 575 Park Avenue at 63rd Street in 1989. Patrick Bateman, the anti-hero of Bret Easton Ellis' American Psycho, dines there in the film version of the book. Allison and Hubert, the couple married in 1984, whereupon she affixed his last name, were unique among the five couples, and among most of their contemporaries, in that they did not come at food and cooking from a French vantage point. "Where did people get their sensibility from?" says Peter Hoffman, who cooked at Hubert's from 1981 through 1985. "They didn't travel to Europe. They were getting it from intellectuals. We were an early participant in what became New American cuisine. It was a combination of local ingredients, but it was also about native ideas, native cooking. What's in our tradition? Why are we always looking to Europe? What are the traditions here of great dishes?" New American cuisine was both about recipes and about source, says Hoffman. "So we began buying direct from producers and being involved with the Union Square Green Market at Hubert's." As with many of the five couples, technique wasn't the Allison's strong suit or priority. "They didn't know from technique," says Hoffman. "So we all brought to it what we brought and where we had been. So that's part of the trajectory." Allison and Hubert's food was even more idiosyncratic than the Pritzker's. In their first year in Manhattan, there was a starter of smoked salmon pâté flavored with dill and aquavit. There was chicken soufflé with morels, turkey pot pie, bourbon-braised pork loin with prunes and assorted purees, sautéed filet of beef with mushrooms, scallions, and crème fraîche. There were also daily specials, including a rotating selection of fish stuffed with fish mousse. In her two-star New York Times review, Sheraton, who remains an ardent fan, chided that "the most consistent culinary flaw is a tendency to sweetness where it doesn't belong." Of the kitchen's intellectual bent, Wesson, sommelier there from 1983 through 1986, says, "It was always a therapy session with spatulas and tongs. There was a lot of introspection, a lot of analysis, a lot of looking back and looking forward, a lot of putting things in context. This is how everybody talked about everything in those days. I think that's because Karen and Len were particularly self-aware. All of these restaurants are defined by their couples. And it's not just their professional experience that defined the way that the restaurants felt if you were working. But it was the whole gestalt of the place." The glove was pulled inside out at Hubert's, says Wesson. "They still wanted to create a great dining experience and do things that were worth doing and different from what other people were doing. But they didn't approach it from the very top tier of existing restaurants. They were kind of doing it from the ground up." The couple also built on the program that was a fixture of the Brooklyn iteration, welcoming chefs and cookbook authors. Len Allison's personality was, according to Wesson, "the dawn of the dead." There were different sides of the brain. Karen was very right hemisphere, emotional, soft, extraordinarily kind, almost poetically kind. Len was much more uptight and controlling, and I think he was both enamored of and threatened by people who were more skilled than him. Wesson raises an important point. In a theme that would repeat itself in various restaurants around the United States throughout the 1980s, many of the chef visionaries were dependent on more technically proficient subordinates to realize their ambitions. According to Wesson, Allison wasn't at peace with that reality. "He was self-trained, and when he would get in the kitchen with someone who was formally trained, had better skills than him, he would learn, of course, but depending upon who that person was, he could be intimidated by them. And sometimes the concrete expression of that tension made for a difficult environment in the kitchen. Len, I thought, was driven to the point where maybe something at a moment in time wouldn't be so pleasant," says Bob Pritzker. "But God, to know him socially was a joy. I enjoyed him. He was bright, giving." Says Sheraton, "Len was sort of a Luftmensch, but she was so darling and simple. They went very well together." Allison's personality quirks aside, Wesson recalls Hubert's positively. The couple, he says, shared a love supreme, and also gave him a wide berth in devising his own wine list, which paralleled the open-minded attitude toward food.
It was an exciting time to be a Somm, because there weren't very many people who were doing that. So it was a tight little group of folks who would commune with one another in this service of finding deliciousness. There was excitement coming from all over the place. The wine world was expanding the way the food world was. If you followed along, you were able to transcend the traditional hierarchies of French fine dining and French wine lists, and boldly go where nobody had gone before.
Hubert's closed in 1991. The Allisons tried another restaurant, Onda, in Soho that same year, but it was gone by 1992. Len Allison taught at the Culinary Institute of America for 3 years. Then the couple moved to Maui, where he took up Chinese medicine and acupuncture. Both Allisons are deceased. Karen died in 1997 at age 49 from breast cancer. Len died several years later.
I was in love.
The second lawyer of the group, David Lederman, a quick-witted and confident nonconformist, was struck by lightning as a young man. Born in New York City, raised in Princeton, New Jersey, Lederman was first turned on to food by Julia Child, but was by no means a sophisticate. In 1969, touring France at age 20, he and a girlfriend visited La Maison Trois Gros, the Rouen restaurant run by brothers Jean and Pierre.
As soon as I walked in the door, I said, "What the fuck is this?" recalls Lederman. "They were serving food that was so far beyond my wheelhouse, I didn't begin to understand it."
When his girlfriend, who spoke some French, saw foie gras on the menu, she exclaimed,
"I'm not eating anybody's liver."
"That's how unsophisticated we were," says Lederman. "I remember the first day. They invented something called la grande dessert. And I remember watching this dessert working its way around the dining room, because when we got there, we were kind of the last people in line. And these two gigantic trays of pastries and ice creams and berries and everything you can imagine that I wanted to eat would come. And they put it down on the table, and then the waiter would ask the guest, 'What would you want?' I watched everybody take a little bit of this and a little bit of this, one or two things, no more. When the guy came to me, I said, 'I'll take a little bit of everything.' You know, the thing was still full. He cleared the table, opened up the wings in the table, and he served me almost 30 little plates of dessert. I was in love." The brothers, as they were apt to do, invited Lederman to return the next day for lunch on them. By the time he left, "I made it my mission somehow, some way, to get back in that place and work there." Back in the States, Lederman attended cooking school with an eye toward the food business. Not necessarily cooking, but just to learn. Whenever he could, he returned to Rouen and Trois Gros, hung around for a few days, spent time in the kitchen. He won his bet with Jean Trois Gros that if he could beat him in tennis, he could work there, an unprecedented proposition for an American. On completing law school and taking the bar exam, he flew to France in 1975. Trois Gros scarcely remembered the wager, but put him to work doing perfunctory tasks. Lederman's big break came in August, when half the staff went on vacation, just as the country was flooded with American tourists. Lederman leaned into the work, became indispensable, experienced what he calls the three-star high of working, sleeping, and participating in soccer games against rival restaurants such as Alain Chappelle. Lederman didn't want to go into the restaurant business, because he witnessed often the spectacle of Jean Trois Gros in agony at the end of a service. But fate had its way with him. After a stock reduction enterprise, Saucier, failed, 25 years ahead of its time, says Lederman, he decided to go into the cookie business. In order to secure a production space at 1016 2nd Avenue near 59th Street, he took the space next door. He enlisted the help of Bobby Shapiro, who with stockbroker Giancarlo Uzielli owned Hoekster's Market restaurant, and launched Manhattan Market in September 1979. Manhattan Market, a gray-walled space decorated with black-and-white photographs and adorned with chandeliers rescued from a Philadelphia train station, served what Sheraton, in a one-star review in the New York Times, termed aggressively nouvelle cuisine. Salmon mousse with snow peas, vegetable terrine and chicken with cold tomato sauce, chicken breasts with lemon-lime glaze, calf's liver with a sherry vinegar sauce, As the Nouvellians were doing in France, Liederman made room for pasta on his menu, such as fettuccine amatriciana. There were pear mousse, lemon almond tart, and a selection of David's cookies for dessert. As the Pritzkers and Allison and Hubert had done before them, Liederman had gone full auto, creating his own distinct oeuvre. As much, if not more, businessman as chef, he was also among the first of his generation to expand beyond the kitchen. In addition to his cookie business, he co-authored a cookbook, Cooking the Nouvelle Cuisine in America, written in collaboration with Michel Hervétor and published by Workman in 1979. For anybody seeking insight into this woefully misunderstood movement, especially on this side of the Atlantic, it's indispensable. He and Hervétor add their own three amendments to the infamous Gold Mio Ten Commandments. The emergence of the chef into the public eye, a focus on plating over platter service, and the fetishizing of vegetables as a thoughtful garnish, which recalls Ken Frank's Gene Wilder-inspired epiphany around the same time. He also co-authored Running Through Walls, about starting a business, with Alex Taylor III in 1989, and David's Delicious Weight Loss Program, with Joan Schwartz in 1990. Additionally, he sold his cookie empire to Fairfield Gourmet Food Corp in 1996. In 1985, the Liedermans, fans of L'Ami Louis in Paris, recast Manhattan Market as Chez Louis, in homage of sorts to the original, finishing the walls a lacquered red and specializing in roast chicken. The restaurant endured until 1991, then was briefly resurrected near Rockefeller Center in 1999. An optometrist who was willing to shell out $200 on white truffles. Nobody knew such a creature existed. Of the two restaurants in this pack that survived for decades, one tells a tale of uptown opulence, the other of downtown artistry. The Quilted Giraffe came first to Manhattan. Barry Wine's conversion from attorney to chef was more swift and unpredictable than either Pritzker's or Liederman's. A Detroit, Michigan native who had practiced law in Milwaukee, then New York City, he and wife Susan, a Barnard College grad, paralegal and hobbyist baker, relocated to the Ulster County village of New Paltz, about 80 miles from Manhattan, in 1970. Taking the ground floor of their home for his office, Barry hung out a shingle and became a self-described country lawyer, with a decidedly 70s caseload. "Most of my practice was wills and criminal work for the students arrested for marijuana," he said. The Wines bought three Victorian houses on Academy Street, converted them to shops, including an art gallery and toy store, specializing in children's quilts, run by Susan. One was slated to become a restaurant, financed by a group of dentists backing a Culinary Institute of America instructor. When they got cold feet, Barry, having invested about $10,000 in the build-out and obtained a coveted New York State liquor license, decided to proceed with the project himself, seeing an opportunity in the ladies who lunch who would no doubt be in need of sustenance after patronizing the Wines' other businesses. A press release promoted the Quilted Giraffe as French Country Dining, promised a violin duet playing everything from show tunes to Vivaldi. Wine had come to know and love good food as a law student in Wisconsin, where a summer in the employ of a Milwaukee attorney and bon vivant meant field trips to Chicago's best restaurants. He and Susan had also taken full advantage of the culinary riches of New York City, shopping at the Upper West Side gourmet emporium Zabar's, supping at La Tesse and other French restaurants. The Quilted Giraffe, which opened in June 1975, with a boyfriend-girlfriend team running the kitchen, didn't live up to the Wines' standards. "On opening night, nobody remembered to wash the spinach," Barry says. "The terrine was still in the refrigerator, and you just opened the refrigerator door, took a slice, and put the terrine back. Nobody knew it should be warmer." Nonetheless, the Quilted Giraffe lurched forward. In February 1976, Brian Vanderhorst reviewed the restaurant in the Village Voice. He found the decor god-awful quaint, but rhapsodized over the food, awarding it 4 V's. In a harbinger of Wine's future chefdom, he had made the blueberry ice cream mentioned in the review, something he still points out today. Most people can't pinpoint the exact day and time they became a chef, but Barry Wine can. By December 1976, another CIA grad, Robert Johnson, was running the kitchen. On New Year's Eve day, he phoned to report that his car had died en route back from a ski jaunt. Wine and his brother-in-law, an orthodontist, went into damage control mode. Says Wine, "Believe it or not, it seems absurd today to think we did it. We sat at a table and said, 'How are we going to serve these people?' There were only 50 people coming for dinner, maybe 75. And there were other people working in the kitchen. And we figured out the system that became the quilted giraffe system, and what I think made the quilted giraffe what it was. And that is, everything was supposed to get cooked in less than 10 minutes. And if you counted backwards and you knew there's a clock on the wall, and said you wanted to serve the main course at 10 after 8, which is 10 minutes after they cleared the apps, you just said, 'Scallops take 4 minutes. Let's wait until 6 minutes after 8 to throw the scallops in the pan and they'll be done.'" Wine survived his trial by fire, realized it wasn't rocket science, and thought he might like to become the chef. "I decided I could do a better job," he says, even though he admits, "I didn't know the first thing about cooking." Shifting gears, the Wines modeled their new life on mom-and-pop French convention. Susan baked and managed the reservation book and dining room. Barry oversaw a crew of CIA grads and took a 3-week night course himself. The Wines made weekly pilgrimages to New York City to shop for food and flowers, sometimes crashing in town and taking in a fancy French dinner. The quilted giraffe was a Sisyphean labor of love. "Today it's very easy to open a restaurant," says Barry, contrasting the deep bench of front and back of house talent and management-worthy veterans currently available to restaurateurs, with the scarcity that confronted his generation. The Wines made a fact-finding trip to France, hit a number of Michelin 3-star restaurants, and Barry, a dreamer and opportunity-seeking missile, saw one in the regard of Nouvelle Cuisine's frontmen. "The first chefs who came in the dining room, that was a new thing," he says, "and I saw the appeal of that." They returned from France freshly charged to take the restaurant to another level. More reviews followed. In July 1977, Gail Green trekked to New Paltz, essayed a love letter in New York Magazine, dubbing the restaurant a "celebration of amateurs," though warning that "amateur passion often lurches into silliness." In particular, she was turned off by giraffes everywhere, from swizzle sticks to a 4-foot-tall inflatable one in the restroom, and some culinary overreaches such as duckling with bananas, banana brandy, and light caramelized banana sauce. The quilted giraffe, already popular with upstaters, developed a Manhattan following. The Wines visited France, returning with new ideas, some of them outright lifts, which in the politics of the kitchen is closer to cinema's homage than literature's plagiarism. A signature offering, his beggar's purses, crepes filled with crème fraîche and caviar, were borrowed from Les Jardins de la Vieille Fontaine in Maisons-Laffitte, a Parisian suburb. Eventually, inevitably perhaps, they couldn't resist bringing their regional hit to Manhattan. They took over a space formerly inhabited by the Bonanza Diner at 955 2nd Avenue, between 50th and 51st Streets, and deepened their Gallic model, and the one followed by André and Simone Soltner at Lutèce, living above the restaurant. The Quilted Giraffe opened there in June 1979. By now, the Wines had 2 children, Winifred and Thatcher, and a dog, Eloise, and the family piled into the car on weekends after the last service, driving upstate to their old home, now a weekend retreat. Over the ensuing years, the Wines grew the Quilted Giraffe into one of the city's powerhouse dining destinations. One of their secret advantages, shared by several members of the 5 couples, was that they had routinely experienced the pinnacle of food and service, both in the United States and abroad. Many aspiring American cooks came from working-class families, had never dined in those restaurants. The 5 couples were people of relative means, seasoned diners who might have been less proficient than formerly trained cooks, but had taste memories and a highly developed sense of hospitality that informed their efforts. Not only did they have the funds or the ability to raise them to open their own restaurants,
but they were well-traveled enough to have a vision of what the experience of eating there should be. Of these trips, which all of the five couples save Allison and Hubert took, Hoffman, who briefly worked at the Quilted Giraffe before switching to Hubert's, says, "They went and ate, and so they were there as an intense crash course education on what fine dining looks like, of which food was an element. And they came back and said, 'Here's how we're going to do wine service,' or 'Here's a dish we want to work on.' They were on par, those two ideas, whereas other people were just in the kitchen doing their work." Says Barry Wine, "It was people like Bobby Pritzker and David Lederman who would go to Europe on these month-long tours. And you might even run into them on the same Michelin three-star route. That's what we did. We took the Michelin three-star route. My perception? The view of American cooking began with Nouvelle Cuisine, of all things. It showed us all that you didn't have to follow the rules. If those guys weren't following the rules, if Michel Girard was making leg of lamb baked in hay and it was in his cookbook, we could have leg of lamb baked in corn husks from New Paltz, cooked on a Weber grill on the front lawn of the restaurant." "It looks different," says Sheraton of Nouvelle Cuisine. "The presentation, the plate arrangement, was something that was different about Nouvelle Cuisine. And that's something that kicked off a lot of the thinking of these American chefs like Pritzker and Wine. Oh, if the French can do it, we can do it. People took a whole new look at how food can be presented, more personal and freer." Sheraton, who describes herself as proudly anti-hype, saw a weakness in the approach favored by many of the couples. "I was very skeptical of these guys," she says, "some more than others. The fact that they were so conspicuously creative, that everything had to be different. And what I didn't like and what I was always wary of in reviewing was that they wanted to be given credit for their goals, for what I'm trying to do, my concept, my philosophy. And to me, it's my dinner. And if it isn't good, I don't care what your goal is." So they were often taken aback by a review that said, "This doesn't work." And then they would say, "Do you know what I'm trying for?" And I felt, "You're not Picasso, going through a rose period or a blue period at my expense." The five couples were also, with the exception of Susan Lederman, a former actress who was the daughter of a Presbyterian minister, it must be said, all Jewish, although it might be something else that set them off from other young cooks in town. "I don't really think it's about Jewish as much as I think it's about class," says Hoffman. "There was the money and the sophistication to be comfortable in the dining room, to appreciate sitting in the dining room as an aesthetic experience. Some people were cooks, and some people were into the restaurant business." "I can only speak for myself," says Karen Pritzker, now Karen Puro. "I think I had an innate understanding of the clientele we had, especially in New York, because I grew up there. My parents, had they still been married, were in a social situation where they would have come to a restaurant like mine." Echoes Susan Wine, "All of the French chefs who grew up in the kitchen, they really did have the apprenticeships, the blue-collar background, but they hadn't been to these restaurants. They didn't have the diner's perspective. We had the American perspective. The customer's always right. We were putting the pieces together from this perspective. That was the one-up that we had on these guys."
As if to make Karen Pritzker's point, Jerry Hayden, a young cook in New York City at this time, visited the Quilted Giraffe in the mid-1980s when he was working at the River Cafe in Brooklyn, and recalls, "I was blown away by the Quilted Giraffe because it was the first time as a cook in New York I started looking at the entire experience, not just the food. I started looking at the bathrooms, which were phenomenal, the atmosphere of the restaurant, the waitstaff, the linens, the plates." Lauren Michelle, who began cooking at the Quilted Giraffe in the mid-1980s, remembers a key lesson Barry Wine taught her, one that flowed from his experience as a diner. If dishes didn't arrive at the pass simultaneously and at optimal temperature, he'd say, "I'm not serving a table. I'm serving customers. We're not serving this table. There are people." The Wines assembled a front-of-house team who could bring his vision of a Michelin three-star level experience to life. Of the five couples, the Wines were the superior capitalists, proudly, repeatedly, deliberately driving their check average north of the highest ones in town. As the 80s, with all of their excesses, unspooled, The restaurant became synonymous with unbridled luxury, bordering on hedonism. Wine served the beggars' purses to customers, instructing them to eat them off the plate or platter without their hands, sometimes handcuffing their hands behind their backs to ensure compliance. The restaurant maintained a humidor, which housed Cuban cigars, illegal at the time, and kept a 77 Rolls-Royce Phantom V idling outside between the neighboring Irish bar and Korean fruit stand to shuttle VIPs to post-meal destinations. Wine recalls the chauffeurs as characters, including a Chinese man who packed a gun and a 6-foot-tall woman. In accordance with the Wines' democratic instincts, rides were offered to every guest from Joe Blow to Warren Beatty to the Rockefellers. The excess knew no bounds. One cook who trailed there, Arnold Rossman, remembers, "All night long they were waiting for the truffles to come. And the truffles are coming. The truffles are coming. The truffles are coming. And at about 10:30, 10:45, all of a sudden there's this aroma. They'd come in the front door. They'd landed at JFK. They came to Quilted Giraffe first. A woman walks into the kitchen. A woman or a man walks into the kitchen with this beautiful woven wicker basket with a big handle and a damask linen napkin over the top. The aroma is overwhelming, and she pulls the napkin, and the thing is filled like this with white truffles. Huge, perfect, gorgeous white truffles. I had never seen anything like that before. And Barry says, "Give me a piece of chocolate cake." And they had this gorgeous triple crazy chocolate cake, and they put a piece of chocolate cake down, and he takes out a truffle slicer, and he slices white truffles over the cake, and he takes a bite out of it. And he's like, "What can we do with this?" I just thought, there's no fucking way I'm going to work in this place. It was too much for me. It was overload. But there was no shortage of people willing to be overloaded. Andy Bursch, restaurant critic for Gourmet magazine through much of the 1980s, credits Wine with helping create or unearth a new clientele. Until the Quilted Giraffe, there was no such thing as a Quilted Giraffe type of customer, which Bursch defines as an optometrist who is willing to shell out $200 on white truffles. Nobody knew such a creature existed. In the kitchen, Wine developed a reputation for playfulness. He had a fondness for puns, such as serving vegetables cut like shoelaces as an accompaniment to sole crepes. Get it? And once created a visual riff on breakfast with a dessert of chocolate, sausage, and poached sweetened eggs. In 1984, at a time when just a handful of restaurants in the city, none headed by an American, held 4 stars, the New York Times' Marion Burroughs, acting critic while the paper searched for a replacement for Sheridan, showered the restaurant with a quartet of them, cementing the restaurant's place as the pinnacle of fine dining at the time. Wine's palate changed with the times. Instead of serving duck with Armagnac or cherry sauce, he might pair it with fried plantains and hot peppers. Lobster and monkfish might find themselves napped with ginger and scallion. As the restaurant drew top talent, a centrifugal force pulled the kitchen toward greater heights. Not unlike Michael McCarty, Wine took a collaborative approach to running the kitchen and had a knack for showmanship. Both McCarty and Wine, says Bob Pritzker, knew how to massage the whole show. "Everybody was smart," says David Kinch, today chef of the Michelin 3-star restaurant Manresa in Los Gatos, California, who began working at the Quilted Giraffe shortly after the review. "Everybody was a lot smarter than me. I went to culinary school, but there was a lot of Catherine Alford. She's a UC Berkeley grad. There are a lot of people who had second careers, but their careers were academic, and they were attracted to cooking. It was almost like a Chez Panisse kind of thing going on. But the food was completely un-Chez Panisse. It was really the ultimate in luxury." This is what sociologists term genius culture, says Wayne Nish, who began cooking at the Quilted Giraffe in April 1984. Where you have an enormous amount of talent that's attracted to one particular place, so there's an explosion of activity. He describes a culinary Saturday Night Live scenario. "Everybody's bouncing ideas off each other. We were trying to outdo each other on a daily basis, whether it was conscious or not. People were vying to get things on the menu.
You have this close-knit community at a point in time where there are influences that are shared in common with a bunch of people and a high degree of interest. All of a sudden, there's a lot of interaction and boom, you get something new.
You weren't pantry and sous chef and all this stuff, says Tom Carlin, who started at the Quilted Giraffe in the mid-1980s. We were all associate chefs, and Barry was open to hearing what everyone wanted to do and selecting different ideas. David Kinch and Catherine probably had the most influence. A few others. He created an environment where we could come up with things. I think he was probably one of the first people to start doing the Asian fusion thing. That was really new. His love of Japanese culture and cuisine. At the invitation of a sake importer, Wine took a transformative trip to Japan in 1985, saw a connection between kaiseki and nouvelle cuisine tasting menus, and took the Quilted Giraffe in an Asian direction. I'm not a chef, Wine told Carlin, according to Carlin. Picture this as the New York Times and I'm the editor. I've got a lot of great writers and I'm going to pick the stories. I'm not writing the stories. I'm not out there doing it. But I know what I want, and I try to hire talented people and pick it up. After relocating the restaurant to New York City, Wine began employing a formerly trained first lieutenant to help realize his ideas. Mark Chayet, a graduate of New York Technical College, was named as chef, along with Wine, in a Food and Wine article profiling rising American toques from around the country in May 1983. Josh Wesson contrasts Wine's openness with Len Allison's fragile ego. I think that Barry was more secure in his role than Len was, and the dynamic in the kitchen was quite different, he says. We used to get scared when Barry picked up a knife to use it, says Carlin, because he didn't know how to use a knife. We thought he was going to cut himself or something. Like me and Tom Colicchio, who started at the Quilted Giraffe in 1985, we were really into, like, how fast can you fillet a fish, or how perfect is your diced shallot, that type of stuff. Barry couldn't do any of that stuff, but he could do a 4-star restaurant. In fact, Wine's lack of formal training, like Jeremiah Towers at Chez Panisse, might have been his greatest strength. One of the great things about Barry was his kitchen was collaborative, says Kinch. He wasn't a French guy who's like, this is my way or the highway, fuck you, kind of thing. Barry, because he was self-taught, would say things or suggest things. He'd go, let's make a béarnaise. Let's use duck fat. Those of us in the kitchen that had been classically trained, we were like, why do you want to do that? You don't do it that way. He'd be like, why don't you do it that way? This sounds quaint nowadays, but back then it was a big deal. And we'd be like, Barry, we can't do it. And he'd be like, just do it. Just do it and see what happens. And of course it wouldn't break. Of course it'd be great. That would be something different. Of course he could think outside the box like that. His eyes were a little more wide open and could see that there's different ways of doing these things, and he used that, says Carlin. That inventiveness extended to the dining room, where, like McCarty and Waters around the same time, Wine attempted to replace the tipping system with a service charge, including the cooks in the pool. I know he got sued and lost, says Carlin, but I like the concept. No one else had done that. He ran his restaurant like a business. That was new. Things were organized. The food went out on a 9-minute schedule. Pick up salmon in 7. Got it. Salmon in 7. Everyone's writing down. That kind of organized way. I don't think anyone was doing that. Chris Major, who cooked at the Quilted Giraffe in the 1980s, recalls the digital watches the cooks used to ensure compliance with the 9-minute timing ritual. I was watching all these people work on digital watches because every course had to be sequenced in 10-minute streams, plus or minus within a minute at the most. And so the level of service was unlike anything I'd seen before. It was almost militaristic.
There was a rhythm, says Michelle. It was almost like a dance in the kitchen where food was in harmony and synchronicity. We basically talked through every technique. Chicken in the pan, searing, flipping, saucing. Veg in the pan. Up in 2. Up in 1. We were walking through. So if the food for a table of 4 was coming up, there was somebody saucing. The expediter was there.
There were two or four waiters there. Their hands were on those plates, ready to go. That was unbelievable, the communication. I've never seen that anywhere else, ever. It's so chaotic in every other restaurant. There's a lot of yelling, a lot of blaming. There was none of that.
Wine also welcomed team members to make technical improvements that helped the kitchen organism evolve. Kinch recalls that Calicio came to work at the Quilted Giraffe after a stage in Auch, France.
That's duck and foie gras territory.
And Tom said, we used to cook duck this way.
And if Tom had said that in any other kitchen, they would have said, shut the fuck up.
Barry said, everybody gather around Tom. Show us how you did the duck.
And if it turns out it was a better way of cooking duck, Barry would say,
okay, this is how we're going to do it now. This is great.
And in fact, it was. And in fact, he did. And we started cooking the way that Tom saw in France. And I was like, what just happened? What just happened? I would have been kicked.
You're always taught you learn how to do things and you learn how not to do things. And you keep your mouth shut. And then you apply your data points elsewhere. Barry wasn't like that. And the things that most affect me now from Barry are the sense of collaboration and the sense of trying new things.
Calicio remembers his training, earning him resentment.
The 10-minute system, which was really a 9-minute system, was run by the sauté position. That's the position they gave me. And I had apparently pissed off a lot of people in the kitchen because that was the position everybody wanted. That was the sous chef's position. And I came in and jumped ahead of everybody. But I could work circles around most people in the kitchen because I had a lot of experience prepping and with the knife. So when a baby lamb came in, everybody kind of looked at it. I was like, give me it.
In addition to staffing his kitchen exclusively with Americans, Wine also helped break another barrier.
Barry had a lot of women in the kitchen at that time, says Kinch. There would be periods of time where 50% of the kitchen were women on the line, and nobody did that then. That was pretty amazing back then.
When I worked at the Quilted, it was almost like a devout respect Barry had for the women in the kitchen, says Michelle. He came in a couple of times a year with earrings for the girls. We had lipstick night. Go downstairs, get ready for service, put lipstick on, put your earrings on, and cook. We all kind of got into it because it was like, okay, we're getting ready to cook. And we were taking charge in the kitchen.
The Quilted Giraffe is not without its detractors. Calicio describes resentment in other chef circles for the Wines' achievement.
A lot of the guys who worked in the French restaurants were like, whatever, because he wasn't one of them. He got 4 stars and came out of nowhere to do it. But it was the idea that Barry would go to France and rip off some dishes and bring them back. Like the beggar's purses. So people knew where they came from. But the critics didn't know. The chefs did. Barry got shit for knocking off people's dishes.
Terence Brennan, a young graduate of Alain Seyoc's kitchen at Le Cirque, who had also cooked for Roger Verger in France, was hired in 1986 as chef de cuisine. He'd never eaten there, but was enticed by the restaurant's 4-star status and stratospheric $65,000 salary.
I just came from such a strong French background. Michelin star restaurants and technique and structure and everyone serious. And there, not one person was professionally trained. Noel Comas, one of Wine's chefs at the Quilted Giraffe, came up through the ranks. Barry wasn't professionally trained either. Some people got together and they happened to get 4 stars. And they would do stuff like the fish came filleted already. I just thought it was a quality thing. You can still get great fish filleted, but at that time my mind was like, oh, that's terrible. They would cut the steak right after they cooked it and all the blood would run out. You know, rest it. Stuff like that that perhaps a professional cook would know about, they would do. I was like a fish out of water. Barry, the way he managed, he had cooks run food up, and he would just come back and play with the food. I remember one time we had an awesome chocolate souffle. There was a food critic out there, and he wanted something, and something else went out. Crème brûlée, or something like that. I can't remember exactly, but he was telling the food critic, this was this. And it wasn't. It was something else. He was insisting, no,
It's this. And he came back and he found out that it wasn't that. And then he'd come by and put orange confit on caviar or something. I just found that he wasn't a good chef. Within 2 weeks, I had to sit down and I said, this is not going to work. So it was just a brief stint.
Rossman remembers of his trail. The food to me was too bizarre. I remember them serving roasted rack of lamb with mustard ice cream, which I thought was the craziest thing ever. Hot and cold. You don't do that. You can have a mustard sauce, but you can't have mustard ice cream.
He also remembers the chef de cuisine and a lead line cook discussing lasagna for staff meal.
He goes, so we need some bechamel. How much do you need? And he goes, I don't know, like 2 or 3 cups. All right, great. Bechamel. You make a roux, add milk. So the guy comes back with 1 gallon of milk, 3 cups of flour, 2 pounds of butter. And I'm looking and I'm going, you've got to make 2 cups. I'm like, these guys have no connection to classical cooking because they're new American cooking. I just thought, that's weird. It just gave me a weird feeling.
And while Marion Burroughs's successor, Brian Miller, upheld the restaurant's 4 stars in 1986, Sheraton included the restaurant on her list of America's most overrated restaurants in a Vanity Fair piece in 1985.
Not to take away from it, says Brennan, offering a glimpse into the resentment many classically trained cooks directed at the Quilted Giraffe. That's great that he could do it. Be a lawyer, open it up, and be 4 stars, and all of us had to work our asses off and get all this training and get our balls busted, and we still don't achieve that. So more power to him.
That was mere background noise, though. The Wines were on top of the world and made the audacious decision to close the restaurant on Saturday and Sunday nights.
The reason for it was that Barry didn't want amateur diners, says Nish. The bridge and tunnel crowd were too difficult to deal with. And as a matter of fact, our cooking was so precise that Monday through Thursday we'd pull a rack of lamb out of the oven at 117, 118 degrees. On Fridays we'd pull it out at 120. It was too rare the other way. We had to make some adjustments on Friday night.
Wine's calculation was that since the restaurant was always fully booked, they'd make as much on a weeknight as they might on a Saturday.
The place was a machine, says Nish. We did 115 covers every night, like clockwork, the highest American Express average in the country. It was a money machine. I know he had topped $3 million in sales. He was doing pretty good.
You guys should open a restaurant.
If the Wines offered the Midtown equivalent of a French 3-star restaurant, David and Karen Waltuck, with their Soho jewel box Chanterelle, created a uniquely downtown translation. David Waltuck grew up the son of 2 New York City social workers in a middle-class Jewish family on a steady diet of American and Middle European home cooking. The Waltucks occasionally splurged on a Broadway show, treating their children to dinner beforehand. The meals were French, not the rarefied air of Lutèce, though he had been there, but one of the unheralded restaurants that dotted the West 40s and did a steady business feeding theatergoers. He was swept away by the elegance and the food. By the time we ordered dinner, David wrote in the Chanterelle cookbook we co-authored, I had the sensation that I was no longer in New York City, but in some otherworldly place devoted entirely to the comfort and contentment of its guests. Those bistros and their cuisine, especially the sauces, seduced the boy. Before long, David was consumed with food, became a voracious reader of culinary tomes. He started baking, quickly shifted to savory, began taking himself through a progression of exercises not unlike a cooking school curriculum, making stocks, mayonnaise, and other basic preparations. He began amassing equipment. His experiments grew more ambitious. Before long, he was making fish mousse, terrines, confit, cassoulet, then combining them into meals. In time, he found his way to Richard Olney's Simple French Food and French Menu Cookbook, which became guiding lights. Waltuck had studied marine biology at City College, graduating in spring 1975, then swiftly course-corrected and matriculated at the Culinary Institute of America. His relationship to the CIA epitomizes much about the 5 couples. Most of them had no formal training,
and Waltuck himself ended up leaving the CIA prematurely. The school bored him. He was caught up in Gaul and Mio's reports of the derring do of Nouvelle Cuisine, and had already begun discovering his voice. Here's a small